Yeah, okay. Thank you for coming to this talk here. We are beginning our Festiva presentations. We have one this morning and we have another one in the afternoon. The afternoon presentation will be about Dr. Garcia's gold. And so some of you may know that we received a donation of 400 gold coins last year of gold that had been buried under a house in San Diego, Texas. During the Great Depression, this town doctor decided that he didn't want to give up his gold to the federal government, so he buried it under his house. And that gold was found in 2002. And so we have the gold. And there's this fantastic story to tell around the gold, which involves like a number of different things. But that's for this afternoon for 2 o'clock. So if you can, come back at two. And really cool political, economic, cultural history of early 20th century South Texas history. Okay, so my name is Francisco Ojardo. I'm the CEO of this museum. And so my colleague this morning.
Hi, I'm Melissa Pena. I'm the archivist here at the museum.
And so our talk today is going to be on the Underground Railroad as it came through South Texas. Okay? And so I think that the way that Melissa and I want to do this is that we want to be as interactive as we possibly can be during the 1 hour that we have. Probably now like 56 minutes maybe. And so if anybody has any, 52 minutes, anybody has any questions, any curiosities during the course of the talk, it's more important to us that we listen to you and engage you in a conversation than it is to, like, you know, give you all this stuff, right? The content. Content is key, obviously, but it's more important, you know, to know what it is that you're thinking about, worrying about, okay? All right, so we're gonna kick it off now. All right, so we're gonna start with with really looking at a little bit of a history of slavery and the Underground Railroad in the United States. And so I want to point out that we've sort of tailored this because we have friends from Region 1 who are here running a grant on teaching American history. And so we wanted to establish certain data points along the way. And so the data points on slavery, especially with South Texas. So there was a slave, Estevanico, who was walking through here in the 1530s. And we actually feature Estevanico and Cabeza de Vaca, a white Spanish guy. Estevanico was, they called him a Moro. So he was a Moorish man who was a black man who was a slave. And so then the second data point is what really has been the rage in the last 5 years or so. There's this New York Times reporter who created this project called the 1619 Project. 1619 is kind of a pushback in American history because American history doesn't really include black people until they came in sort of large waves as slaves. But actually, 1619 is when the first African slave arrived on a ship to Virginia. So 1619 Project. I push back against that because Estevanico was here in the 1530s. So if we just paid attention to American history, it's coming from the bottom up as well, mm-hmm. right? So there's that. And so then the third data point is that in 1787, as the founding fathers are creating the Constitution, there's this debate about what are we going to do with representation and for like congressional seats and that sort of thing. And the big debate is really about what to do. Well, there's really two big debates. Like with Native people, do you count them? Not count them. With slaves, do you count them? Okay, yes, says the South, you have to count them because we need to have our numbers up, the South says, for more representation in Congress. But the North, actually the North wants to count them. The South wants to count them also, but the North says, no, if you're enslaving them, then we shouldn't count them. The South says, no, but they're here, we should count them. So then there's a compromise to count each slave, 3 million slaves, by the way, at that time in the US, as 3/5 of a person. The 3/5 compromise is part of the history of slavery. There is the Austin Expedition. This is Stephen F. Austin. Stephen F. Austin, who brings people to Central Texas. The reason Stephen F. Austin is important is because Stephen F. Austin brings Sylvia Hector. Or at least a family brings Sylvia Hector. I'll get to Sylvia Hector in a bit. But 1829, Mexico abolishes slavery. That's really, really key. 1834, the Freedom Papers of Sylvia Hector are signed. Sylvia Hector is freed. We're going to get into Sylvia Hector in a bit. 1852, the Webbers migrate to the river. 1857, the Jacksons migrate to the river. A family that would become a conducting family on the Underground Railroad. Same thing with the Jacksons. That's my brother. I'll call you back. I'm going to tell him. Okay. And then And then 1861, Civil War starts, and really the central issue there is slavery. I mean, they also say that it's states' rights and other kinds of things, but slavery is at the center of the whole thing. And then the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. So Melissa's going to tell you something about the Emancipation Proclamation. Go ahead and tell them now.
Okay, so a couple weeks ago, it was at the end of last year, right? So we needed to spend some money that was left over in a budget. Our budgets start over in the new year, and so we had some money left over, and we're looking at different auctions and stuff, and an original copy of the Emancipation Proclamation came up for auction. And we really thought, like, yes, that's something that you can see elsewhere. We could always put up a copy of it, but to own an original document like that, I think, was really important. And something that, oh yeah, come on in. No, you're fine. Something that that we talked about was, oh, I lost my train of thought. No, but it is important to have something, an original document like that, to see it and to own it and to let the kids here see it and know that we own it, I think was really important.
It was a broadside that was printed.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
So, you know, during the 19th century, even into the early 20th century, printing presses would print whatever big thing happened that day, you know, or at that time period. And so they were called broadsides. They would put them, you know, nail them to public buildings.
Yeah.
And so when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by President Lincoln in 1863, printing presses printed them to announce to the public. Well, we have one of those. We have an original.
Like three or four printing presses that printed this, and this was, we can pinpoint which one did this one. And what's amazing about ours is it's in decent condition. And if you think about these were, you know, when someone loses a dog and they go and they put up the sign or whatever, and then like later on somebody puts another sign on top of it, that's the equivalent of what this is. So the fact that it's in beautiful condition, it doesn't have a lot of holes. So nobody ripped it down. It wasn't outside. So it's probably inside of a courthouse or inside of a building. So we have that and we're really excited about it. Like, I think it's a great piece to have.
Yeah, so as we add to our 19th century exhibit, so this is a 19th century South Texas exhibit. It's called River Highway. And we use a steamboat, which we're inside of a steamboat now, as a central feature of 19th century South Texas history. But, you know, we got this stuff around it, right? So what's this? You know, why do we have cotton in the, well, because cotton was actually transported. Okay, well, who harvested this? Well, nowhere in the story of our 19th century exhibit do we say there was slaves that drove the economy. So it's an important addition to it. We're not revising the history, we're adding to the history. Okay, and then of course, 1865, when Congress passes the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery. So just to give you kind of a thumbnail sketch of this is not depth. This is just very kind of like timeline-ish, just so you can have a sense of it. But then we move into South Texas. I should have said. Okay, so the triangle trade that happened, which is really what moves, you know, like slavery into the Americas. And I think what I want to point out here is the Atlantic trade, because I'm going to get to the Atlantic trade shortly. Okay, so the Atlantic world and economy and trade in the Atlantic world has so much to do with the story of today. All right, the number of slaves in this country, just so you can kind of get a glimpse of it. And so slavery kind of begins to be imported here about 1700, even though there's evidence 1619. And then it really picks up. And if you look at the eve of the Civil War, we already have like close to 4 million slaves in the United States. How many people had been enslaved by that time? Well, the number is, cumulative number, as many as 10 million in the U.S. That's not a small number. The population in the U.S., when the U.S. was created, was about 4 million people, 1776. So you look at this, oh my God. And when you know that slavery was inextricably linked to the economy, then it was almost impossible for this country to separate itself from it. That's why we had a civil war. It was too hard to separate it. How do you do it? Well, you got to kill each other to do it. Okay. This is kind of how it moves. In 1790, this is where the preponderance of slaves were. By the eve of the Civil War, this is where they were. And there's a reason for this. And the reason for this is that the economic world, by the very late 1700s, early 1800s, moved away from wool. Think about this. Wool. Wool was what was trafficked across the Atlantic world. When Eli Whitney founds the cotton gin, and we have a cotton gin right on the other side of this, in about 1793, Más o menos, Eli Whitney is the creator of the cotton gin. All of a sudden, we have a way to mass produce cotton. And so the Atlantic world finds that cotton breathes better, cotton is better than wool, and cotton is cheaper to actually harvest. But it can only be cheap if you have laborers to be able to pick it. So when you look at this, this means the Atlantic world moving away from wool and moving into cotton. So what you have with the expansion of slavery, as this diagram shows, this map shows, the expansion of slavery was because of the expansion of cotton. So when Stephen F. Austin comes to Central Texas, he's coming to Central Texas so that he can have farmland to grow and harvest cotton. And of the 297 families that he brought, just about every family had one slave, at least. In some cases, three or four. Not huge numbers of slaves, but they had slaves. So Stephen F. Austin brings slaves. Okay. And I didn't get to the thing, Melissa, but we have manacles. And this is not a picture of the manacles. This is another picture. But I have a picture of manacles that we hold in our collections. I just didn't have time to get to it. Manacles becomes kind of a feature for enslavement. We have manacles here that were donated in the 1970s by a woman who moved from Kentucky. And her family had actually collected quilts. And so we have two quilts made by slaves that we're going to feature in our exhibit here. And we're going to feature the manacles as well. And then we're going to feature what I'm about to get to here shortly. Okay. This is kind of a snapshot of the Underground Railroad as it is traditionally understood in American history. There was all kinds of movement north. So when we think of the Underground Railroad, you just ask anybody, right? Any kind of like, you know, lay person out in the street. And if they're kind of aware of history and you ask them about the Underground Railroad, everybody kind of is reminded of Harriet Tubman. Everybody's reminded of, oh yes, going up north, right? North of the Mason-Dixon line, perhaps. And of course, the central character here is Harriet Tubman. This is a photograph of Harriet Tubman about 1870. Harriet Tubman was a contemporary of the people that I'm about to feature here in our talk. In fact, Harriet Tubman was probably a little bit younger, about 10 years younger than Sylvia Hector. Harriet Tubman was born about 1820, more or less. Sylvia Hector was born 1807. So just kind of keep that in mind. Harriet Tubman becomes a great liberator, and she kind of like is connected to this whole narrative of American history about the Underground Railroad. Okay, so just to remind us of the chronology here. And so we're going to tell family stories about how families actually did this. But the important thing here to note is this. This. In 1829, as slavery in the U.S. is at full force, slavery in Mexico is being attacked by the Mexican government and the Mexican Republic. Mexico just had a very few, like 10,000 slaves is what Mexico had when Mexico became free from Spain. The U.S. had millions, Mexico had 10,000. So for Mexico, it wasn't as hard to move away from slavery. And then when Mexico had this one president named Vicente Guerrero, Vicente Guerrero was actually a mulatto, and he was president of Mexico. And Vicente Guerrero wants to abolish slavery. And he does in 1829. And if you're a slave somewhere in the U.S., a territory, a state, whatever, slaves talk. They have networks. Word gets down that Mexico abolished slavery. And if you go to the book, 12 Years a Slave, by Solomon Northrup, who was enslaved. He was a free man who was captured in Washington, D.C., sent to Louisiana. He wrote in his book, 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote after he was freed, about how there was chatter in the bayou, he said. He was in Louisiana. chatter in the bayou in plantations of slaves plotting to run away to Mexico. So as soon as this happens, slaves are talking. And if you're a slave in Central Texas, you're a slave in the Houston area, anywhere close to Mexico, and if you're thinking of running away, you're not going Harriet Tubman up to the Mason-Dixon line. That's 2,000 miles away. This here can be 300 miles away, 400 miles away. It can be hard to be sure, right? But it would be a better bet. And so there were as many as 10,000 runaway slaves that went into Mexico before and even during the Civil War, right? Between the 1830s, more or less, and about the 1860s. And according to Alice Baumgartner, who wrote this fantastic book entitled South to Freedom, and also the book that Maria Esther Hammack is about to publish, she already has, but she wrote in her dissertation in 2021. So she wrote the story on Sylvia Hector that I'm going to share with you. And so they both say that it probably was about 10,000 runaway slaves. Of course, this is hard to document because nobody was saying, hey, count me. All this was completely stealthy. It had to be. If not, you could risk your life. Anybody along the process, all the way from the freedom seeker to the helper of the freedom seeker. So as far as we know, más o menos, about 10,000. Okay, and they're going down into Mexico. And how are they going? Well, some of them could have gone on horseback. And there's enough documented evidence of slaves stealing horses to run away. So okay, so
I'm just kidding.
One of the reasons Stephen F. Austin came to Central Texas is because New Spain, Nueva España, did not like how the Comanches were overrunning Central Texas. Overrunning Central Texas for what? To steal horses. To steal horses for what? For the cotton industry. So the more cotton came west, the more the Comanches and the Apaches were finding economic opportunity. So the Comanches and the Apaches, they weren't stealing horses just because they were horse thieves. No, it was for the economy. Because the whole, like, past the Mississippi River Valley, that was fair game for the cotton industry and slaves. They needed horses. Who was going to provide the horses? Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah. And they even went into Mexico to steal horses because they had a purpose for them. To take them up to the slave industry, to the cotton industry. Yeah, so that's not a joke. That's actually, like, it's right there. But that's actually a story also of the Apaches and the Comanches that is not told with balance. They're just marauding people, you know, is how they're told in history. But actually, they were, like, you know, they were also profiting in the economy of the time. And you know what? I wasn't completely fair because if you go to this, okay, if you go to this, this is actually about black slavery. But there's a fascinating book written by Andres Resendiz entitled The Other Slavery, where he documents as many as 3 million people in the Americas who were enslaved, who were indigenous people. The Other Slavery, that's a compelling story. And in Mexico, in the mines, who do you enslave? You can enslave native people because they're cheaper to enslave than African slaves who are so expensive to go catch, to maintain, to bring past the Middle Passage. But the native people are also very risky because they knew the terrain and they could escape whenever they wanted. But the other slavery. I didn't write that on here. I should. Okay, for the next part of it. All right. So first story is about Matilda Hicks and Nathaniel Jackson. So Nathaniel Jackson was a white man in Alabama who was a slaveholder. In the 1830s, he freed all his slaves and married one of them. And that one that he married was a girl who had been his best friend when they were growing up in the plantation. So he, like a member of the family of the owners, she, a slave, fell in love with her. And when he came of age and then he owned the slaves, he freed them and he married this one. So they began to have children. In Alabama, in the 1840s, it was almost untenable to be raising a mixed race family. So when they heard about Mexico abolishing slavery, the Jacksons, Matilda Hicks, born a slave, Nathaniel Jackson, a white man, with their family, the Jacksons decide in 1857 to come to South Texas. Actually, to go to Mexico. But they don't make it into Mexico because they find that along the river, it's a pretty good life. So the Jacksons settle in South Texas. They buy 5,500 acres worth of farm and ranch land right north of the river, south of Far. That's where they landed. And the Jackson Ranch would be right about here. Right there is where the Jackson Ranch is and where they have a church today. Now, the Jacksons today, you know, they look Mexican-American, and they are. Because by the second generation, like Martin married Espiridiona, you know, a local woman, right? And then somebody else married, and so they become Mexicanos. And so today there's some Jacksons, but mostly they're like Ramirez's. Mostly they're, you know, other names, Cardenases. And so the Jackson descendants are people like you all. But Nathaniel Jackson and Matilda Hicks became conductors on the Underground Railroad. They bought this piece of land, and then they welcomed people who were running away to freedom. They gave them refuge. There's documentation that actually some of the people, they didn't even lead into Mexico. They stayed on the ranch. Runaway slaves stayed on the ranch. And we know this because people were complaining about them in the 1800s. The Jacksons were not telling the story from generation to generation. They were not. It was a dangerous story. But now that some of this research is coming up, because we're consulting archives in Mexico and we're consulting other memoirs, and they're pointing to the Jackson Ranch, you know, as a safe haven for slaves. Now we're going to the Jacksons and asking them, what do you, and they say, you know, there was something in how my grandmother used to tell stories, but she kind of kept this thing out of it. So it's a fascinating case study, the Jacksons, and how they kept the story. They suppressed the story. But now that there's corroborating evidence, now the Jacksons are thinking, I think there's something there. And they're going to the family albums and the family documents and finding, yes. And so we found one guy who's in his mid-70s, Ramiro Ramirez, who's telling stories. And he says, yes, my grandmother, Nancy Jackson, used to tell stories of how we used to have religious revivals here at the ranch. And that those religious revivals were part of how they had this spiritual fervor that was very compatible with helping runaway slaves. So the Jackson family is a fascinating story there. And this is where they are. So this is how the river goes. The river, of course, has moved through the years, but you can kind of get a sense for it, right there. This is this is the bridge that takes you into Reynosa over by the airport, and the Jackson Ranch is there. There's a little cemetery right here. That's where my grandmother is buried. Águeda Cantú is buried there. She lived in Capote Ranch. Capote Ranch was part of the whole Jackson Ranch territory. Bootlegging, very, very common here during Prohibition. That's where the Jacksons are. FAR would be up there, as you know. Yeah, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol right there, and yes. Okay. This is a Jackson Ranch church. This is as it looks today. And I'm going to show you a couple of images here. Okay, this is an aerial of the church, and then this is a photograph of today. So you see some conspicuous imagery there. What? What do you see there? What else? What else do you see in the background? The border wall, yeah. So there's a cemetery right here of the family. There's a cemetery, and then there's another cemetery right there of the Jackson family. So there's a couple of cemeteries, and you see the border wall up here. This border wall, when it was constructed, it unearthed a few bodies. That's Tony, by the way, that guy right over there. Yeah, he's like, looks like he's working. Way to go, Tony. he was working. I can vouch for that. Oh, but the...
So what happened when they were, I'm sorry, when they were on Earth, what happened?
I actually don't know exactly what happened, but my guess is that they were reinterred. Hopefully. Yeah, I think. Yeah, but I mean, the family told stories about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to move from the Jacksons you know, who are conductors of the Underground Railroad, and then I'll show you some evidence in a little bit about that. And I'm moving now to Sylvia Hector. So Sylvia Hector is a woman who was owned by John Cryer. John Cryer would come with the Austin Expedition. So Stephen F. Austin mostly recruited people in Missouri and in other parts of the South. So Missouri wasn't quite like the classical Southern state, but he brought people from Louisiana. He brought people from Mississippi. 297 families come to Central Texas. And so they're looking for opportunities, right? And Mexico, it was New Spain, and then 1821 it became Mexico, and that's when Stephen F. Austin comes in the 1820s. So Mexico is wanting to populate that part. So, but Mexico wasn't expecting that Stephen F. Austin was going to bring slaves. Well, one of the slaves that comes is this very young girl by the name of Sylvia Hector, born in 1807. Remember, Harriet Tubman born about 1820, Sylvia Hector born 1807. Okay, Sylvia Hector comes with the Cryer family. Sylvia Hector then meets a white man by the name of John Weber, a man who was from Vermont, who had been a veteran of the War of 1812. And he had some training in medicine, so he would become a doctor. John Weber comes because there's this excitement in Texas around the Austin Expedition. So Weber comes and eventually meets this slave girl and falls in love with her. They have a couple children. In 1834, John Weber buys her freedom. So we have a scanned copy of the Freedom Papers. 1834. The Freedom Papers are dated 1834. By the way, this is where the Austin Colony was. And you can see down here, I don't have the fullness of the state of Texas, but the Austin Colony is people who were coming from different places here. And so where they came, Cryer, he actually came from the territory of Florida in current day Louisiana. But it was like the Florida territory. Okay, so these are the Freedom Papers. And so these Freedom Papers, Maria Hammock, historian Maria Hammock, she's a professor of history at Ohio State University, found the Freedom Papers at the Briscoe Center for American History at UT at Austin. And the Freedom Papers say this. Okay, so signed by Weber and signed by Cryer. John, I don't know where Cryer's signature is, but that's John Weber. John Ferdinand Weber signed it. And so this is how it reads. And let me see if I can read it with you guys. It says, in the town of San Felipe de Austin, that's Austin, Texas today,
The 11th day
of June of 1834. That's 34. That's a 3, and that's a 4. So the rest of the narrative there is how the sale was consummated. The Freedom Papers say this. Cryer says, Sylvia Hector, you'll be free. In exchange, you didn't want any money. He wanted 2 babies. He wanted a 2-year-old right now, and he wanted a 2-year-old at a future date. And if you don't pay with the 2 babies, Weber, you're buying. Weber, you will forfeit your property to me. Okay. Any predictions of what would happen? What do you think happened?
They ran away.
They ran away? That's a good guess. How about you?
They gave them the kids.
They gave them the kids? Okay, good guess.
Came
you what?
They came after him.
They came after him. Okay.
I think they ran away, possibly.
Possibly? You think they ran away? Yeah? Do you know the story at all?
I know the story.
Oh, okay. You can't see. How about you? What do you think? You know the story? Okay.
Probably try to go to Mexico.
Ah, okay. You know the story, so you can, yeah.
Do
you know
the same?
The same, okay. I'm not going to ask you.
No, I know the story.
So Maria Hammock found in the Travis County clerk's office a document in 1850, 16 years after. By the way, in the middle of it, Sylvia Hector and John Weber married through the Catholic Church. And Maria Hammack, the historian, found a document that states that Weber gave up his property to Cryer. Weber had like a whole town, Weber's Prairie, which is today Webersville, outside of Austin. It's right on the river, on the Colorado River. And so he had like a whole thing there, you know, and he had, I mean, the town was named after him. He was a prominent citizen. He had a lot of land. He gave it up because that was his collateral. Sylvia kept the babies. Sylvia would not give up her babies. That is like history. That is, to me, like a bright light in history. That is tantamount to Sojourner Truth and to Harriet Tubman. Sylvia Weber, to me, because of that act and other things that she would do, is like an American hero, a character in American history that should be studied. Just on that story.
What a love story.
Did they ever try to get their land back, like after, you know, the emancipation?
Oh my God, that's such a good question that I have no idea what the answer to it is.
That's what you said. That's a great question.
Melissa says that whenever you say that's a great question, because I don't know the answer.
I always say that.
But
that's a great question.
Actually, so my guess is that I believe not.
Yeah.
I believe that if you're living in the 1850s, 1860s, to make your way back to Weber's Prairie would have been such an ordeal that, you know, it would take a couple of years of planning, and then it takes a couple months to get up there on wagon, and then to come back, and then now you're aging now. And I would suspect not, and there's no evidence that that happened either.
But there's we also have the book written by the man who knew him.
Right.
I don't remember his name. And in that book, he talks about how the town first loved her. She was incredible. Everybody loved her. They called her Aunt Puss. And she would take people in, and the rest of the town somewhat accepted her. And what happened was more people from the South started moving in, and they were the ones who were like, what is going on here? And so I think in that new, and then this gentleman who, it was his memoirs, and he knew them personally, told Weber, you've got to get out of here. This is not, you can't stay here anymore.
And he says Mexico is a good place.
He said go to Mexico.
So this guy named Noah Smithwick, who was a contemporary of theirs. And he also described Aunt Puss, Sylvia Hector. He described her as being like a woman who helped with medicinal needs, a woman who was always the first one to respond to people in need. And then when she sent her children to the little school there, they didn't allow the children. So then she had to teach them in the way that she could. She had been a slave. And so Sylvia Hector is a fascinating case study. And so I'm waiting for the book to be written, which is going to be published by Maria Hammack. But a few more things here. So according to Maria Hammack, this is kind of, you know, what she would have looked. So this is an artistic rendering of Sylvia Hector. This is where they had their land, Weberville. Was Weber's Prairie. This is a late 1800s map. And this is where Sylvia Hector is buried, at the Weber Family Cemetery. And the Weber Family Cemetery is like right there. This is a cemetery, and the border wall is right there. And so this is south of Donna. This is where they bought their farmland, the Webers. And so the Weber Ranch would have been right around here. The Webers, so the story that I haven't told, is that when they gave up their land, they then moved to South Texas, where they bought 8,500 acres worth of farm ranch land just north of the river. By 1853, John Weber had received a license, and we found this in the Hidalgo County Clerk's Office. I saw it, and it said, John Ferdinand Weber receives a license to operate a ferry. And the family story says that he ferried runaway slaves into Mexico. And he helped his neighbor, the Jacksons. They didn't know each other until they came to live together. They moved. the Webers predate the Jacksons. The Webers came in 1852 to South Texas, where they would buy this farmland and they would immediately become, so this is más o menos, like this is my art, 8,500 acres worth of farm and ranch land. And so the river's here. So there's a point there, and you can actually go to it today. There's a point where that's where they like docked their ferry. Yeah. It's fascinating history. And so they would ferry runaway slaves into Mexico. And the Jacksons and the Webers, both mixed race families, would become like compadres, and then the kids would kind of like marry each other and that sort of thing. And so this is south of Donna. This is south of Far and Alamo. In fact, the church today has an Alamo address. 13,000 acres.
It's interesting how the wildlife refuges are both in those areas, and mm-hmm. they still preserve the history of this area yeah. better than the 90% of the rest of the border, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So their legacy lives
on. So here's how the legacy, I don't know if it was conscious or not, but was attacked. I'm going to tell you a story of how there's a counter to this narrative here of the Jacksons and the Webers and this being an outpost on the Underground Railroad. When John Clauser became county sheriff, and then John Clauser became a very large landowner, John Clauser bought most of this. And they called it the San Juan Plantation. And he built a pump house. Pump house would have been like right around here. And out of that pump house, you know, he used unlimited water to grow the most beautiful sugar cane. And so that most beautiful sugar cane is what he entered in the World's Fair in 1904 in St. Louis, Missouri, and won the gold medal for the best crop in the world based on this. And he did it in what used to be the outpost on the Underground Railroad. I don't know if Clauser was from Wisconsin. I don't know if Clauser was like fully aware of the story of how these people had escaped enslavement and that sort of thing. I don't know if, you know, but the empirical truth is that this was an outpost in the Underground Railroad. And then late in the 1800s, early 1900s, Clauser converted into another plantation around, you know, crops and that sort of thing. I think that's an interesting story.
With the sugar cane factory closing down.
That's right. Yeah, in Santa Rosa, yeah. So this is, I was at a quilt show in San Antonio one day a couple years ago at the Carver Community Center. And so I was looking at all these quilts that had been made by different people in the community, including some African-American people in the east side of San Antonio. And I'm taken, you know, by this one quilt. And I go to it and I see it. I say, oh my God, it is a quilt that was made by this woman named Lillian Jones, a retired physician. Dr. Jones made a quilt that she entitled The Tex-Mex Underground Railroad. And down here, she tells the story of the Jacksons and the Webers. We didn't know this person. She didn't know us. But she was doing her own research on the Underground Railroad into South Texas. And so I saw this quilt and I thought, oh my God, this is unbelievable. And it was an art show, a quilt show, where things were for sale. So I immediately called Melissa and I said, Melissa, this is what I'm looking at. And so then we immediately say, well, let's buy it. And so we bought this quilt from Dr. Jones. And so at some point, Dr. Jones is gonna come to the museum. We're gonna install this quilt. We're gonna put it up as part of how we open up. We're gonna have the freedom papers, like over there. We're gonna have the manacles here. We're gonna have the quilts. And we're gonna tell a story of how slavery came through South Texas. And we're going to feature this quilt right on that wall over there because it's a perfect place for it.
Did she have connection
yes.
the family, with the Jackson or Weber family?
Doesn't know anybody.
She was just Le Nacio.
She had gone to a talk and heard about it. And then afterwards, down that rabbit hole. And yeah.
So I'm going to pause now because that kind of is what the story is. All right, so I'm going to pause to see if anybody has any questions or any reflections about any of this.
I do.
Yes.
I'm probably the oldest person here. I grew up in Edinburgh, and I can assure you that the first I heard of this was when I came to work here at the museum. I'd never heard of, and I went to school with the Ramirez's, mind you, with Dr. Sylvia and Dr.
Yes.
Jack.
Ramiro Ramirez.
They're Jacksons. And I had a conversation with my babysitter, who's much older than I may add, and I was telling her about this and what I had recently learned. And she shared with me, this was growing up in Edinburgh, that because in our Hispanic culture, you know, and my mother's from Laredo, and we're very much focused on the European influence in our culture. And in every family, there's always one child that's more fair-complected than everyone else, and they cater to that one. And that's the common, you know, the commonality. And my little babysitter told me that when she was growing up, that they were told young men not to date, and it included the last names of Jackson, Weber, Singletary.
Wow.
They had the family names, and they said, you know, you do not go out with these young men for fear that, love comes into play and you marry. They were so concerned about the purity of the blood, you know, and it's so European, that influence. And my mother would tell me when she married my dad in Laredo, Texas in 1948, my mother's family is very fair complected, very common, blonde, blue-eyed, but my dad, it has the indigenous, you know, blood, the dark hair, you know, and my grandfather would tell her, do you really want to marry this man? You know, he was so concerned about, you know, the influence.
You know? Well, you know, in the oral histories that we've been conducting with the Jackson family members and with the Webbers, both, and they're not even talking to each other, you know, independently, they both tell the story of the politics of skin color, and how they are convinced, you know, after like reflecting on a number of anecdotal instances, they're convinced that this is why they didn't share, because they didn't want us to be subject to some kind of stigma around our own biological blackness. I'm paraphrasing, but that's kind of how they say it.
You know, you're so strange too.
And anybody else? Thank you, Lali. Appreciate that story.
My question is, being from Mexico, what happened to those individuals that moved into Mexico? Like, do you know more or less what areas they relocated to? Because I know Mexico is a population of individuals. As a matter of fact, last year we attended a conference in South Padre Island, and we had a lady from Oaxaca, African descent, Mexican, that came and taught about her history.
Yeah.
And now that you're talking about how they moved and migrated to the south into Mexico,
Let me share with you some contemporaneous narratives that I think begin to respond to your question. And so the first one is about Matilda Hennis, not Matilda Hicks, but Matilda Hennis, another woman. And I'm getting this from this book. But then I went and I saw the archives. And so the archives are in El Archivo de Matamoros, Archivo Histórico de Matamoros. So the story is about this guy named Cheney and Matilda. Matilda Hennis was a slave who had a baby in Louisiana. In 1832 or so, she escaped. What's the date on this? I think it was 1832. She escaped, she came to Reynosa. Crossed the border, went to Reynosa with her baby. Eventually, she finds employment with the family of Luis Manuel del Fierro in Reynosa, Tamaulipas, right? Okay. She becomes the housekeeper, Matilda. Cheney, through the grapevine, found out where his former property was. He's the slave master. He hires a slave catcher, and they make the trek all the way down to Reynosa. They find her. They go into the house late one night. Cheney and the slave catcher. The slave catcher goes and grabs the baby. They go into the bedroom where Matilda lived as the housekeeper. The slave catcher goes and grabs the baby runs outside as Matilda is yelling at the top of her lungs. As she's yelling, El Señor del Fierro y la Señora, they come to the bedroom. What's going on? When they come in, they find that the slave catcher's taking the baby out and goes and gets a horse and races off. But while this is happening, Matilda's yelling. Del Fierro's come in. They find Chaney with a gun. This is a story that I'm getting from this book that was gotten from this archival material, in El Archivo Histórico de Matamoros. So Chaney is grabbing Matilda, and she is at gunpoint. Del Fierro comes in. La Señora comes in, and she hears the yelling and sees this drama. She goes up to the balcony and begins to yell out to the community. So a bunch of people from Reynosa come. It was immediate. And a bunch of people, you know, also went after the man on the horse with the baby. They chased him down, they caught him, took the baby, and the guy escaped, the slave catcher. We don't know what happened to him. Slave catcher escaped. A bunch of people then go into the house and they overpower Chaney. They grab his gun, they take him to jail. Chaney goes through a trial in the ensuing days. In Mexico, in Reynosa. The judge says this. The judge says, okay, two things are going on here. Number one, La República de México has something that is called the Freedom Principle. Countries that have the Freedom Principle at that time were countries that did two things. Number one, they didn't have slaves. They had abolished slavery. Number two, they don't extradite. So he said, okay, so you are taking property that is not yours. You believe she is your property, but not here. Okay? So we don't have slavery, and we don't extradite, and we're sending you to jail. So Chaney is found guilty of attempted theft, and he's thrown in jail. Think about that story. Think about, were that story included in the history books? What that would do to children studying history. Second story, equally fascinating to me. This is a story of Merli. Okay, so follow me with Merli. This same archive, República Mexicana, you know, archives. And so I'm going to get into the story of Merli. Merli, en 25 de junio de 1859, it's June 1859, Merli, mujer de color. So we're talking about a black woman who lived in Brownsville, but spent a lot of time in Matamoros. 1859, this is two full years before the Civil War. This is what Merli did. Merli was communicating con el alcalde de Reynosa, the mayor of Reynosa. Merli was telling the mayor of Reynosa that there was a family, the Henderson family, that had escaped from slavery. And so if you follow the document here, notice what the document says here. La familia Henderson, hombre de color, a black man, compuesta está de su mujer, Ana, y cuatro hijos, y que habían venido de los Estados Unidos para librarse de la esclavitud. You're getting an honest-to-goodness document in the Mexican archives that nobody's written about before that says... Yeah, hey, no, and it's right there. It said, you know, U.S. historians have typically not gotten to the Mexican archives because you got to know how to read Spanish. Well, this... Maria Hammock found this document. And so this is what Merli is saying. Alcalde, Mayor, by the way, thank you, Tony, for the graphics on this. This is Tony doing graphics on archival stuff. Merli is saying to the alcalde, alcalde, there are some slave catchers that are coming to get the Hendersons. And the slave catchers are posing as small livestock buyers. But don't be fooled by the mayor. They're slave catchers and they're going after the Hendersons. Familiares? I know, you're all over the place. You got connections to George Washington and all kinds of people. Betsy Ross era tía de Lali. But okay, unpack this story. Think about it. And think about the kind of the classical definition on the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad was about a network of people working to help free slaves. A network of people. What's Medley doing if she's not working the network? Here, along the border, Medley is happening in history. And there's archival documents that tell us this. Imagine being a kid in fifth grade, seventh grade, fourth grade, in an Edinburgh school, in a Progreso school, and seeing this. What does that do to a child when you see this? That people here who are your ancestors were actually, they had kind of a high moral ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, okay. So just to be fair, there were slave catchers who were Mexicanos too. I mean, it was an industry. It was an industry. But there's a lot of evidence that the Jacksons and the Webbers that and the people like Merli and that the judge in Mexico, the Los del Fierro and other people were very complicit in this very dangerous and very illegal thing that was happening in the name of humanity. I think that is a beautiful story that's fraught with all kinds of complexity, but I think that it's worth, like, you know, kind of grappling with this story. This is South Texas history.
The stories of the women that took part in it. And the women's strength and the empowerment of women that nobody really recognized.
Sylvia, bright light.
Yeah.
Merli, bright light. Mm-hmm. Matilda, bright light. La Señora del Fierro, bright light.
Mm-hmm.
But American history teaches us about Harriet Tubman. And you know, todo respeto a Harriet Tubman. But come on. There's all this other stuff here. We don't have to rely on Harriet Tubman only. You know, Harriet Tubman is like a reference point, right? Harriet Tubman is a heavy. But there's other heavies here that have a much closer connection to children who are in our classrooms. Because Harriet Tubman is like out there, you know, it's like she's kind of elusive. How do you grab that? You can grab aquí, you know, Sylvia Hector. I went to high school with Lily Weber and Linda Weber. At Cauchosa High School. They were from Monte Alto. Lily Weber and Linda Weber, cuatas, their grandmother 5 generations ago was Sylvia Hector.
Wow. That's crazy. My son's teacher is Ms. Weber, and I've been sitting here thinking, I wonder if they're
really with one B or two B's?
Two B's.
It's probably this family. Yeah. It's probably this family. Mexican American? Almost a slam dunk.
How about like Webb County? Was it named based on Webbers?
No.
That's
another Webb.
That's another story.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of the presentation. You know, happy to hang out with you guys and do some other things. I mean, I feel compelled to also share, you know, that we triangulate the data here. This is a document from the late 1800s where this one guy is writing about the Jackson Ranch. And so this guy, he writes about the Santa Cruz and Capote ranches are inhabited entirely by Mexicans. But Jackson's Ranch is a Negro settlement, which has grown up from runaway slaves having settled there and intermarried with Mexicans. Eli Jackson, the principal man of the settlement and from whom it is named, is county commissioner. Eli Jackson, like he was light-skinned, he got away with it. He could be county commissioner. You know, Jackson Avenue, Jackson Street, Eli Jackson, yeah. And so he was commissioner for the second precinct and occupies a prominent place in the affairs of Hidalgo County. So that's interesting. That's interesting. And then there's Rip Ford also. He was a Texas Ranger. He was the mayor of Austin, mayor of Brownsville. He owned a press and he kept his memoirs. He wrote prolifically. And so his memoirs are like, I don't know, 20 volumes. And so this is one of his memoirs, also at the Briscoe up at UT in Austin. And there he wrote, this is contemporaneous stuff. First of all, he's all a secessionist, right? And so he wrote about that. He was an officer with the Civil War, but he was like self-appointed. Nobody appointed him. But he was kind of interesting in that way. But then he wrote about this. He wrote about Weber. He said, so Ford proceeded to the ranch of John McCallan, Esquire, right? Some distance below the town of Hidalgo, formerly called Edinburgh. So you know Hidalgo used to be called Edinburgh. And just below Mr. Weber lived. This is Rip Ford writing. And this was transcribed years later. He was an old Texian, because he came with Stephen F. Austin. He was an old Texian. He was there, you know, for the battle of, you know, of Texas. But he wasn't like Stephen F. Austin. He would not enslave people. In fact, he married one of them, right? And then he would participate in freeing others. A town named after him, Weberville, 16 miles below Austin. His house was visited. He closed the doors, refused admission until Ford came. This is Rip Ford. Ryan in the third person. Yeah. His sons were made prisoners. One of them escaped and went to Fort Brown. He told him Ford was blah, blah, blah. He saw, so Rip Ford writing about, and then he called him in another reference, he called him a Union sympathizer. There's slave narratives. So some of you may recall during the Great Depression when a lot of scholars were out of work, the federal government through New Deal put a lot of scholars to work, including historians. And the federal government said, go find people who were slaves who are still living. So a bunch of former slaves in the 1930s were found and oral histories were done with them. The slave narratives, a great gift to us. And so this is Felix Hayward, who was 93 years old, lived in San Antonio. And in his slave narrative, you can find these easily. Like just Google search.
Online Google.
They're all online. They're all like, you know, beautifully transcribed. Felix Hayward says, oh yeah, there were all kinds of runaway slaves coming through my place. He was a slave. And that they would say, hey, Felix, let's go. And he would say, no, I'm okay here. I'm okay being a slave. I'm taking care of you. I'm okay. But others were not okay. And they tried to encourage Felix. And he talked a lot about the pathway and the passage to the Underground Railroad. He saw them. And he talked. He was like maybe, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old, you know, before the Civil War. And then the war breaks out. And he's now 9 and 10 years old. And so he had a very clear recollection of these stories. So Federal Writers Project, you can read some of that. Also the stories of Ben Kinchlow. Ben Kinchlow had a mother who was a slave. So he was born a slave, but his father was the master. And his father, you know, kind of felt guilty, I think. And he said, you know what, go down to Matamoros. And so Ben Kinchlow then, in his slave narrative, when he was 91 years old, he also lived in San Antonio, and he eventually moved to Uvalde, Ben Kinchlow. His great-grandson is like a preacher, mega preacher kind of guy. Kinchlow is the guy's name. So anyway, Ben Kinchlow told the story of how in Matamoros, where he lived with his mother, he saw all these runaway slaves coming on boats. On boats. Coming from Galveston, coming from Houston, coming from New Orleans. They were hidden in the boat. And then as soon as they landed in Matamoros, they were free. Because Mexico had abolished slavery. So he told those stories. So we have all of these accounts. We have the account of this woman named Helen Chapman. Helen Chapman, her husband had been an officer in the Mexican War, and then they stayed. And so her husband was kind of like the quartermaster. He laid out all of Brownsville. He laid out all of Corpus Christi eventually. But she was prolific with her letter writing back to her mother who was in New England, and she wrote about runaway slaves. This is contemporaneous stuff, very contemporaneous. Like here, Captain Anderson, who commands the U.S. steamer Mentoria, this is about 1852, on his way up to Brownsville from the Brazos, when near the mouth of the river saw a boat containing 4 runaway Negroes who were making their escape into Mexico. So we have all of these accounts of how this was happening. This was happening. So Melissa's reference was to Noah Smithwick, a guy who lived in the 1830s, 1840s, and he knew Weber. And so notice how he describes his, and thank you, Tony, for the imaging here. So Tony does this first. And so Weber, having become entangled, he says, notice the use of language. In a low amour, se enamoró, but with a kind of a low class person. A low amour, the result of which was an offspring, which, though his own flesh and blood, was the property of another. Oh my God. So the baby was born, but he was the property of the master, crier. Without whose consent he could not provide nor protect. He couldn't protect his own child. He faced the consequences like a man. Too conscientious to abandon his yellow offspring. Whew, word use. You can do a lot here in language arts, right? Notice word selection. How loaded the words are. Yellow offspring and its sable mother. Oh. To a life of slavery, he purchased them from their owner. Remember the freedom papers? This is it. This is a guy referencing that. Who, cognizant of the situation, took advantage of it to drive a sharp bargain. Building himself a fort in the then unsettled prairie, Weber took his family home and acknowledged them before the world. There were others I wot of that were not so brave. The Weber family, of course, could not mingle with the white people, and owing to the strong prejudice against free Negroes, they were not allowed to mix with the slaves, even had they so desired. So notice the bottom paragraph. He says, I abhorred the situation, but I honored the man for standing by his children, whatever their complexion. But the bitter prejudice, coupled with a desire to get Weber's land and improvements, became so threatening that I at length counseled him to sell out and take his family to Mexico, where there was no distinction of color. He took my advice, and I never afterwards saw or heard of him. Noah Smithwick about the Webers, who then came, you know, and become, you know, your children's elementary teachers. Yeah. Yeah. Incidentally, just one final note here. So the federal government created this legislation called the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom, an act in 1998. And this is to begin to document. The National Park Service is empowered with documenting sites on the Underground Railroad. And these are the sites. Aquí, nada. Yeah. Wow. It's a matter of time. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of time. Because this story of the Jacksons and the Webers is a powerful story where there will be eventually dots down here. I'm convinced of that. Okay, so that's the end of the talk. Melissa, do you want to talk about what we're going to do with this? I mean, I think we've referenced it.
I mean, we did, but yeah. So I want to start this story. I don't know if, did you take them through? Anyway, if you come back there, there's a bell behind that. I really believe is where the story needs to start because it doesn't start here in this boat. It needs to start early 1800s, and we need to talk about why certain things happen, all the cause and effect. Yes, we remember the Alamo, but for different reasons sometimes. So in here is where I will do the quilts. These three bales will come out, and we have two quilts that were made, that were brought down from Kentucky, and those will go there, and then the art piece will go in the middle. And I have called it an art piece because it is, that's what it is, but I think in her learning about this history,
this is Dr. Jones. So she's not a contemporaneous person. We do have two slave quilts that Melissa's describing, but she, mm-hmm. we're seeing this as a work of art. It's a work of historical art, her quilt, which was made in 2022.
Yes, and it was a way of her to process what she's learned. And I feel like a lot of us need to be able to do that. This is not history we've ever heard before. This is something new, it's something different. And I want that to really be like, okay, how are you going to leave this situation, leave this new history, this new information, it's not new history, but new information, and go back and think about it and process it. Her way of doing it was this quilt. And it's incredible, it's beautiful, and so we'll do that here. On this wall is where we will talk about the manacles. I'm going to install that here, and we'll talk about everyone who brought people in, brought the slaves, enslaved people in, and what they, where they lived, how they lived, and then how they escaped. And so this will kind of be that area. And then we'll move into, and I wanna put the Emancipation Proclamation on the other side, which is kind of where it goes in history. But that'll be a revision. We talk about things over there already. We talk about things over here already, but we need to tell a broader story. You're in this room and you look around and there's really just this, right? And there's so much more to the story than steamboats and cargoes. So we've got to expand on that and talk more on to what kind of cargoes and where the steamships go. And they really did play such a big part. We look at the river now and you can't imagine this kind of trade coming up and down the river on steamboats, but they were there because the river was larger, it was deeper. You know, we know that it went up to Galveston and it went up to Louisiana. And so, yeah, so this is where more of that story will be told.
All right, last thoughts. We're going to go around. You don't have to say like full paragraphs, just mm-hmm. like one thought. And tell us who you are.
My name is Jesus Mendoza.
Jesus Mendoza. One last thought, and we're going to do it quickly, Jesus.
Something really interesting about the river.
I'm
Daniela
Flores. I'm from Mexico City. What caught my attention was that, like, how people fell in love back then, even with all the prejudice, and out of that love created stories for us to know and to create history. I found that amazing.
Thank you for your comment. There's an interesting demographic reality at that time, is that there were not a lot of women in the frontier. And so for a lot of these guys who are looking for a woman, mm-hmm. they went to a slave woman. And that's actually intermarriages at that time between white men and black women, Mexican men and black women, and native men and black women were not uncommon. So this story is actually replicated in the archival material. You see it over and over again. Yes.
I'm Brianda Garza. I'm a UTRGV student. She's actually my professor. And just the reflection that I had was, I wish this was in the TEKS. Like, I wish this was taught to children here in South Texas, because I really think they would benefit from hearing these stories.
Mm. Let me sit on this for a second, on what you just said, because in the audience today, you have people who have a lot to do with how teacher training is done. So we have administrators here from Region 1 who are actually overseeing 64 different campuses on a training on American history. And so you heard what she said. And what she said is like highly provocative, but so compelling as well. I wish this were in the TEKS. Oh my God.
And because she's a pre-service teacher, she brought me into the profession, and we discussed this in class, how we need to embed our own local histories and then learn the larger, you know, history. But first, mm-hmm. focus here mm-hmm. and then expand. Like your exhibit that is going to start telling the story first and then the emancipation.
Yeah. Yeah.
How it lives.
So we're not going to have the conversation now, but I think it would be important for two faculty members at the university in the pre-service program, right? Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
That you guys would do well to be talking to these folks from Region 1, because these guys also they're content deliverers, but they're much more than that, right? They deal with pedagogies, they deal with everything, really. So these are folks who are working a grant from Teaching American History out of the U.S. Department of Education. And so these are all administrators who actually facilitate and manage this process of what teachers get in terms of content, in terms of other things too. That's the reason they're here this morning, which is the same reason you all are here, right? Because but thank you for your question, because in some ways it is, I'm sorry that's too idealistic, but in other ways, you're absolutely right. That is the point. Right? I'm sorry it's too idealistic. We're not going to deal with it because it's not in the TEKS. It's not tested. But what grabbed you this morning is stuff that wasn't on the TEKS, but there's so much about human drama that connects with you. That's your challenge, to figure out how to reconcile those two worldviews that are through policy and practice.
Pearl River, and I'm a Virginia one, so I'm one of the people that you're speaking at. And I guess just to speak to what you said, I think that, I mean, just my personal opinion, is maybe we shouldn't look at it as if it's not in the teaks, because it's not that it's not in the teaks. It's that the teaks are essentially malleable to some extent. And yes, the aspect of slavery is in the teaks. Yes, Civil War is in the teaks. Yes, the issues of colonization, assimilation, all of those are in the teaks, but it's in how you deliver it to the students. Mm. And with the grant, the beauty of it is that we're trying to harness that feeling that you have right there, that beauty of, I'm falling in love with this information, I want to know about it, and I want to explore it. We're trying to harness that and give that to other teachers so that they can then utilize that as a vehicle to teach their students in a more relevant way. Because once there's relevancy, then the kids grab onto it, and they remember it, and they love it. And history becomes alive and a beautiful story of love, a story of heroism, as opposed to, I don't know, it's like dead guys. They have nothing to do with me. You know, and it's all about the perspective and how it's told.
I thought I was dramatic. She's so dramatic. It was like so beautiful.
It was good. No, that was wonderful.
Yeah, record that. Yes. But yes, good.